of society, of habits, of thought, engendered by the preoccupation with technological problems, the habits of thought of the natural scientist and the engineer, and how these, at the same time, tended to discredit the results of the past study of society, which did not conform to their prejudices, and to impose ideals of organization on a sphere to which they are not appropriate. The author has made an attempt to trace the beginning of this development in two series of articles on Scientism and the Study of Society and The Counter-Revolution of Science, which appeared in Economica, 1941 to 1944. All we are here concerned to show is how completely, though gradually, and by almost imperceptible steps, our attitude toward society has changed. What at every stage of this process of change had appeared a difference of degree only has, in its cumulative effect, already brought about a fundamental difference between the older liberal attitude toward society and the present approach to social problems. The change amounts to a complete reversal of the trend we have sketched, an entire abandonment of the individualist tradition which has created Western civilization. According to the views now dominant, the question is no longer how we can make the best use of the spontaneous forces found in a free society. We have, in effect, undertaken to dispense with the forces which produced unforeseen results, and to replace the impersonal and anonymous mechanism of the market by collective and conscious direction of all social forces to deliberately chosen goals. The difference cannot be better illustrated than by the extreme position taken in a widely acclaimed book on whose program of so-called planning for freedom we shall have to comment yet more than once. "We have never had to set up and direct," writes Dr. Karl Mannheim, "the entire system of nature as we are forced to do today with society. Mankind is tending more and more to regulate the whole of its social life, although it has never attempted to create a second nature." Man and Society in an Age of Reconstruction, 1940, page 175. It is significant that this change in the trend of ideas has coincided with a reversal of the direction in which ideas have traveled in space. For over 200 years, English ideas had been spreading eastward. The rule of freedom, which had been achieved in England, seemed destined to spread throughout the world. By about 1870, the reign of these ideas had probably reached its easternmost expansion. From then onward, it began to retreat, and a different set of ideas, not really new but very old, began to advance from the East. England lost her intellectual leadership in the political and social sphere, and became an importer of ideas. For the next 60 years, Germany became the center from which the ideas destined to govern the world in the 20th century spread east and west. Whether it was Hegel or Marx, Liszt or Schmoller, Sombart or Mannheim, whether it was socialism in its more radical form or merely organization or planning of a less radical kind, German ideas were everywhere readily imported and German institutions imitated. Although most of the new ideas, and particularly socialism, did not originate in Germany, it was in Germany that they were perfected, and during the last quarter of the 19th and the first quarter of the 20th century, that they reached their fullest development. It is now often forgotten how very considerable was the lead which Germany had during this period in the development of the theory and practice of socialism. That a generation before socialism became a serious issue in this country, Germany had a large socialist party in her parliament, and that until not very long ago, the doctrinal development of socialism was almost entirely carried on in Germany and Austria, so that even today, Russian discussion largely carries on where the Germans left off. Most English and American socialists are still unaware that the majority of the problems they begin to discover were thoroughly discussed by German socialists long ago. The intellectual influence which German thinkers were able to exercise during this period on the whole world was supported not merely by the great material progress of Germany, but even more by the extraordinary reputation which German thinkers and scientists had earned during the preceding 100 years, when Germany had once more become an integral and even leading member of the common European civilization. but it soon served to assist the spreading from Germany of ideas directed against the foundations of that civilization. The Germans themselves, or at least those among them who spread these ideas, were fully aware of the conflict. What had been the common heritage of European civilization became, to them, long before the Nazis, Western civilization, where Western was no longer used in the old sense of Occident, but had come to mean west of the Rhine. Western, in this sense, was liberalism and democracy, capitalism and individualism, free trade, and any form of internationalism or love of peace. But in spite of the ill-concealed contempt of an ever-increasing number of Germans for those shallow Western ideals, or perhaps because of it, the people of the West continued to import German ideas, and were even induced to believe that their own former convictions had merely been rationalizations of selfish interests, that free trade was a doctrine invented to further British interests, and that the political ideals of England and America were hopelessly outmoded, and a thing to be ashamed of. Chapter 2. The Great Utopia. What has always made the state a hell on earth has been precisely that man has tried to make it his heaven. F. Hölderlin. That socialism has displaced liberalism as the doctrine held by the great majority of progressives does not simply mean that people had forgotten the warnings of the great liberal thinkers of the past about the consequences of collectivism. It has happened because they were persuaded of the very opposite of what these men had predicted. The extraordinary thing is that the same socialism that was not only early recognized as the gravest threat to freedom, but quite openly began as a reaction against the liberalism of the French Revolution, gained general acceptance under the flag of liberty. It is rarely remembered now that socialism, in its beginnings, was frankly authoritarian. The French writers who laid the foundations of modern socialism had no doubt that their ideas could be put into practice only by a strong dictatorial government. To them, socialism meant an attempt to terminate the revolution by a deliberate reorganization of society on hierarchical lines and by the imposition of a coercive spiritual power. Where freedom was concerned, the founders of socialism made no bones about their intentions. Freedom of thought they regarded as the root evil of 19th-century society, and the first of modern planners, Saint-Simon, even predicted that those who did not obey his proposed planning boards would be treated as cattle. Only under the influence of the strong democratic currents preceding the Revolution of 1848 did socialism begin to ally itself with the forces of freedom. But it took the new democratic socialism a long time to live down the suspicions aroused by its antecedents. Nobody saw more clearly than de Tocqueville that democracy, as an essentially individualist institution, stood in an irreconcilable conflict with socialism. "Democracy extends the sphere of individual freedom," he said in 1848. "Socialism restricts it. Democracy attaches all possible value to each man. Socialism makes each man a mere agent, a mere number. Democracy and socialism have nothing in common but one word, equality. But notice the difference. While democracy seeks equality in liberty, socialism seeks equality in restraint and servitude." To allay these suspicions, and to harness to its cart the strongest of all political motives, the craving for freedom, socialism began increasingly to make use of the promise of a new freedom. The coming of socialism was to be the leap from the realm of necessity to the realm of freedom. It was to bring economic freedom, without which the political freedom already gained was not worth having. Only socialism was capable of effecting the consummation of the age-long struggle for freedom, in which the attainment of political freedom was but a first step. The subtle change in meaning to which the word freedom was subjected, in order that this argument should sound plausible, is important. To the great apostles of political freedom, the word had meant freedom from coercion, freedom from the arbitrary power of other men, release from the ties which left the individual no choice but obedience to the orders of a superior to whom he was attached. The new freedom promised, however, was to be freedom from necessity, release from the compulsion of the circumstances which inevitably limit the range of choice of all of us, although for some, very much more than for others. Before man could be truly free, the despotism of physical want had to be broken, the restraints of the economic system relaxed. Freedom, in this sense, is, of course, merely another name for power or wealth. The characteristic confusion of freedom with power, which we shall meet again and again throughout this discussion, is too big a subject to be thoroughly examined here. As old as socialism itself, it is so closely allied with it that almost 70 years ago, a French scholar, discussing its Saint-Simonian origins, was led to say that this theory of liberty est à l'issue tout le socialisme. Paul Janet, Saint-Simon et le Saint-Simonisme, 1878, page 26, note. The most explicit defender of this confusion is, significantly, the leading philosopher of American left-wingism, John Dewey, according to whom liberty is the effective power to do specific things, so that the demand for liberty is demand for power. Liberty and Social Control, Social Frontier, November 1935, page 41. Yet, although the promises of this new freedom were often coupled with irresponsible promises of a great increase in material wealth in a socialist society, it was not from such an absolute conquest of the niggardliness of nature that economic freedom was expected. What the promise really amounted to was that the great existing disparities in the range of choice of different people were to disappear. The demand for the new freedom was thus only another name for the old demand for an equal distribution of wealth. But the new name gave the socialists another word in common with the liberals, and they exploited it to the full. And, although the word was used in a different sense by the two groups, few people noticed this, and still fewer asked themselves whether the two kinds of freedom promised could really be combined. There can be no doubt that the promise of greater freedom has become one of the most effective weapons of socialist propaganda, and that the belief that socialism would bring freedom is genuine and sincere. But this would only heighten the tragedy if it should prove that what was promised to us as the road to freedom was, in fact, the high road to servitude. Unquestionably, the promise of more freedom was responsible for luring more and more liberals along the socialist road, for blinding them to the conflict which exists between the basic principles of socialism and liberalism, and for often enabling socialists to usurp the very name of the old party of freedom. Socialism was embraced by the greater part of the intelligentsia as the apparent heir of the liberal tradition. Therefore, it is not surprising that, to them, the idea of socialism's leading to the opposite of liberty should appear inconceivable. In recent years, however, the old apprehensions of the unforeseen consequences of socialism have once more been strongly voiced from the most unexpected quarters. Observer after observer, in spite of the contrary expectation with which he approached his subject, has been impressed with the extraordinary similarity, in many respects, of the conditions under fascism and communism. While progressives in England and elsewhere were still deluding themselves that communism and fascism represented opposite poles, more and more people began to ask themselves whether these new tyrannies were not the outcome of the same tendencies. Even communists must have been somewhat shaken by such testimonies as that of Max Eastman, Lenin's old friend, who found himself compelled to admit that, instead of being better, Stalinism is worse than fascism, more ruthless, barbarous, unjust, immoral, anti-democratic, unredeemed by any hope or scruple, and that it is better described as super-fascist. And when we find the same author recognizing that Stalinism is socialism in the sense of being an inevitable, although unforeseen, political accompaniment of the nationalization and collectivization which he had relied upon as part of his plan for erecting a classless society, his conclusion clearly achieves wider significance. Stalin's Russia and the Crisis of Socialism, 1940, page 82. Mr. Eastman's case is perhaps the most remarkable. Yet he is by no means the first or the only sympathetic observer of the Russian experiment to form similar conclusions. Several years earlier, W. H. Chamberlain, who in 12 years in Russia as an American correspondent had seen all his ideals shattered, summed up the conclusions of his studies there and in Germany and Italy in the statement that socialism is certain to prove, in the beginning at least, the road not to freedom, but to dictatorship and counter-dictatorships, to civil war of the fiercest kind. Socialism achieved and maintained by democratic means seems definitely to belong to the world of utopias. A False Utopia, 1937, pages 202-203. Similarly, a British writer, F. A. Voigt, after many years of close observation of developments in Europe as a foreign correspondent, concludes that Marxism has led to fascism and national socialism because, in all essentials, it is fascism and national socialism. Unto Caesar, 1939, page 95. And Walter Lippmann has arrived at the conviction that the generation to which we belong is now learning from experience what happens when men retreat from freedom to a coercive organization of their affairs. Though they promise themselves a more abundant life, they must, in practice, renounce it. As the organized direction increases, the variety of ends must give way to uniformity. That is the nemesis of the planned society and the authoritarian principle in human affairs. Atlantic Monthly, November 1936, page 552. Many more similar statements from people in a position to judge might be selected from publications of recent years, particularly from those by men who, as citizens of the now totalitarian countries, have lived through the transformation and have been forced by their experience to revise many cherished beliefs. We shall quote, as one more example, a German writer who expresses the same conclusion, perhaps more justly than those already quoted. The complete collapse of the belief in the attainability of freedom and equality through Marxism, writes Peter Drucker, has forced Russia to travel the same road toward a totalitarian, purely negative, non-economic society of unfreedom and inequality which Germany has been following. Not that communism and fascism are essentially the same. Fascism is the stage reached after communism has proved an illusion. And it has proved as much an illusion in Stalinist Russia as in pre-Hitler Germany. The End of Economic Man, 1939, page 230. No less significant is the intellectual history of many of the Nazi and fascist leaders. Everyone who has watched the growth of these movements in Italy or in Germany has been struck by the number of leading men, from Mussolini downward, and not excluding Laval and Quisling, who began as socialists and ended as fascists or Nazis. An illuminating account of the intellectual history of many of the fascist leaders will be found in Robert Michel's, himself a former Marxist fascist, Socialismus und Faschismus, Munich, 1925, Book 2, pages 264-266 and 311-312. And what is true of the leaders is even more true of the rank and file of the movement. The relative ease with which a young communist could be converted into a Nazi, or vice versa, was generally known in Germany, best of all to the propagandists of the two parties. Many a university teacher during the 1930s has seen English and American students return from the continent uncertain whether they were communists or Nazis, and certain only that they hated Western liberal civilization. It is true, of course, that in Germany before 1933, and in Italy before 1922, communists and Nazis or fascists clashed more frequently with each other than with other parties. They competed for the support of the same type of mind and reserved for each other the hatred of the heretic. But their practice showed how closely they are related. To both, the real enemy, the man with whom they had nothing in common and whom they could not hope to convince, is the liberal of the old type. While to the Nazi, the communist, and to the communist, the Nazi, and to both, the socialist, are potential recruits who are made of the right timber, although they have listened to false prophets, They both know that there can be no compromise between them and those who really believe in individual freedom. Lest this be doubted by people misled by official propaganda from either side, let me quote one more statement from an authority that ought not to be suspect. In an article under the significant title of The Rediscovery of Liberalism, Professor Eduard Heimann, one of the leaders of German religious socialism, writes, "Hitlerism proclaims itself as both true democracy and true socialism. And the terrible truth is that there is a grain of truth for such claims, an infinitesimal grain to be sure, but at any rate enough to serve as a basis for such fantastic distortions. Hitlerism even goes so far as to claim the role of protector of Christianity. And the terrible truth is that even this gross misinterpretation is able to make some impression. But one fact stands out with perfect clarity in all the fog. Hitler has never claimed to represent true liberalism. Liberalism, then, has the distinction of being the doctrine most hated by Hitler." Social Research, Volume 8, Number 4, November 1941. It deserves to be recalled in this connection that, whatever may have been his reasons, Hitler thought it expedient to declare in one of his public speeches as late as February 1941 that, basically, National Socialism and Marxism are the same. Cf. The Bulletin of International News, published by the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Volume 18, Number 5, page 269. It should be added that this hatred had little occasion to show itself in practice merely because, by the time Hitler came to power, liberalism was, to all intents and purposes, dead in Germany. And it was socialism that had killed it. While to many who have watched the transition from socialism to fascism at close quarters, the connection between the two systems has become increasingly obvious. In the democracies, the majority of people still believe that socialism and freedom can be combined. There can be no doubt that most socialists here still believe profoundly in the liberal ideal of freedom, and that they would recoil if they became convinced that the realization of their program would mean the destruction of freedom. So little is the problem yet seen, so easily do the most irreconcilable ideals still live together, that we can still hear such contradictions in terms as individualist socialism seriously discussed. If this is the state of mind which makes us drift into a new world, nothing can be more urgent than that we should seriously examine the real significance of the evolution that has taken place elsewhere, although our conclusions will only confirm the apprehensions which others have already expressed. The reasons why this development cannot be regarded as accidental will not appear without a rather full examination of the main aspects of this transformation of social life. That democratic socialism, the great utopia of the last few generations, is not only unachievable, but that to strive for it produces something so utterly different that few of those who now wish it would be prepared to accept the consequences. Many will not believe until the connection has been laid bare in all its aspects. Chapter 3. Individualism and Collectivism. The socialists believe in two things which are absolutely different and perhaps even contradictory: freedom and organization. Elie Halévy. Before we can progress with our main problem, an obstacle has yet to be surmounted. A confusion largely responsible for the way in which we are drifting into things which nobody wants must be cleared up. This confusion concerns nothing less than the concept of socialism itself. It may mean, and is often used to describe, merely the ideals of social justice, greater equality, and security, which are the ultimate aims of socialism. But it means also the particular method by which most socialists hope to attain these ends, and which many competent people regard as the only methods by which they can be fully and quickly attained. In this sense, socialism means the abolition of private enterprise, of private ownership of the means of production, and the creation of a system of planned economy in which the entrepreneur working for profit is replaced by a central planning body. There are many people who call themselves socialists, although they care only about the first, who fervently believe in those ultimate aims of socialism, but neither care nor understand how they can be achieved, and who are merely certain that they must be achieved, whatever the cost. But to nearly all those to whom socialism is not merely a hope, but an object of practical politics, the characteristic methods of modern socialism are as essential as the ends themselves. Many people, on the other hand, who value the ultimate ends of socialism no less than the socialists, refuse to support socialism because of the dangers to other values they see in the methods proposed by the socialists. The dispute about socialism has thus become largely a dispute about means and not about ends. Although the question whether the different ends of socialism can be simultaneously achieved is also involved. This would be enough to create confusion, and the confusion has been further increased by the common practice of denying that those who repudiate the means value the ends. But this is not all. The situation is still more complicated by the fact that the same means, the economic planning, which is the prime instrument of socialist reform, can be used for many other purposes. We must centrally direct economic activity if we want to make the distribution of income conform to current ideas of social justice. Planning, therefore, is wanted by all those who demand that production for use be substituted for production for profit. But such planning is no less indispensable if the distribution of incomes is to be regulated in a way which to us appears to be the opposite of just. Whether we should wish that more of the good things of this world should go to some racial elite, the Nordic men, or the members of a party or an aristocracy, the methods which we shall have to employ are the same as those which could ensure an equalitarian distribution. It may, perhaps, seem unfair to use the term socialism to describe its methods rather than its aims, to use for a particular method a term which for many people stands for an ultimate ideal. It is probably preferable to describe the methods which can be used for a great variety of ends as collectivism, and to regard socialism as a species of that genus. Yet, although to most socialists only one species of collectivism will represent true socialism, it must always be remembered that socialism is a species of collectivism, and that, therefore, everything which is true of collectivism as such must apply also to socialism. Nearly all the points which are disputed between socialists and liberals concern the methods common to all forms of collectivism, and not the particular ends for which socialists want to use them. And all the consequences with which we shall be concerned in this book follow from the methods of collectivism irrespective of the ends for which they are used. It must also not be forgotten that socialism is not only by far the most important species of collectivism or planning, but that it is socialism which has persuaded liberal-minded people to submit once more to that regimentation of economic life which they had overthrown because, in the words of Adam Smith, it puts governments in a position where, to support themselves, they are obliged to be oppressive and tyrannical. Quoted in Dugald Stewart's Memoir of Adam Smith, from a memorandum written by Smith in 1755. The difficulties caused by the ambiguities of the common political terms are not yet over if we agree to use the term collectivism so as to include all types of planned economy, whatever the end of planning. The meaning of this term becomes somewhat more definite if we make it clear that we mean that sort of planning which is necessary to realize any given distributive ideals. But, as the idea of central economic planning owes its appeal largely to this very vagueness of its meaning, it is essential that we should agree on its precise sense before we discuss its consequences. Planning owes its popularity largely to the fact that everybody desires, of course, that we should handle our common problems as rationally as possible, and that, in so doing, we should use as much foresight as we can command. In this sense, everybody who is not a complete fatalist is a planner. Every political act is, or ought to be, an act of planning. And there can be differences only between good and bad, between wise and foresighted and foolish and short-sighted planning. An economist, whose whole task is the study of how men actually do and how they might plan their affairs, is the last person who could object to planning in this general sense. But it is not in this sense that our enthusiasts for a planned society now employ this term, nor merely in this sense that we must plan if we want the distribution of income or wealth to conform to some particular standard. According to the modern planners, and for their purposes, it is not sufficient to design the most rational permanent framework within which the various activities would be conducted by different persons according to their individual plans. This liberal plan, according to them, is no plan, and it is, indeed, not a plan designed to satisfy particular views about who should have what. What our planners demand is a central direction of all economic activity according to a single plan, laying down how the resources of society should be consciously directed to serve particular ends in a definite way. The dispute between the modern planners and their opponents is, therefore, not a dispute on whether we ought to choose intelligently between the various possible organizations of society. It is not a dispute on whether we ought to employ foresight and systematic thinking in planning our common affairs. It is a dispute about what is the best way of so doing. The question is whether, for this purpose, it is better that the holder of coercive power should confine himself in general to creating conditions under which the knowledge and initiative of individuals are given the best scope so that they can plan most successfully, or whether a rational utilization of our resources requires central direction and organization of all our activities, according to some consciously constructed blueprint. The socialists of all parties have appropriated the term planning for planning of the latter type, and it is now generally accepted in this sense. But though this is meant to suggest that this is the only rational way of handling our affairs, it does not, of course, prove this. It remains the point on which the planners and the liberals disagree. It is important not to confuse opposition against this kind of planning with a dogmatic laissez-faire attitude. The liberal argument is in favor of making the best possible use of the forces of competition as a means of coordinating human efforts, not an argument for leaving things just as they are. It is based on the conviction that where effective competition can be created, it is a better way of guiding individual efforts than any other. It does not deny, but even emphasizes, that in order that competition should work beneficially, a carefully thought-out legal framework is required, and that neither the existing nor the past legal rules are free from grave defects. Nor does it deny that where it is impossible to create the conditions necessary to make competition effective, we must resort to other methods of guiding economic activity. Economic liberalism is opposed, however, to competitions being supplanted by inferior methods of coordinating individual efforts. And it regards competition as superior not only because it is in most circumstances the most efficient method known, but even more because it is the only method by which our activities can be adjusted to each other without coercive or arbitrary intervention of authority. Indeed, one of the main arguments in favor of competition is that it dispenses with the need for conscious social control, and that it gives the individuals a chance to decide whether the prospects of a particular occupation are sufficient to compensate for the disadvantages and risks connected with it. The successful use of competition as the principle of social organization precludes certain types of coercive interference with economic life. But it admits of others, which sometimes may very considerably assist its work and even requires certain kinds of government action. But there is good reason why the negative requirements, the points where coercion must not be used, have been particularly stressed. It is necessary in the first instance that the parties in the market should be free to sell and buy at any price at which they can find a partner to the transaction, and that anybody should be free to produce, sell, and buy anything that may be produced or sold at all. And it is essential that the entry into the different trades should be open to all on equal terms, and that the law should not tolerate any attempts by individuals or groups to restrict this entry by open or concealed force. Any attempt to control prices or quantities of particular commodities deprives competition of its power of bringing about an effective coordination of individual efforts, Because price changes then cease to register all the relevant changes in circumstances, and no longer provide a reliable guide for the individual's actions. This is not necessarily true, however, of measures merely restricting the allowed methods of production, so long as these restrictions affect all potential producers equally, and are not used as an indirect way of controlling prices and quantities. Though all such controls of the methods of production impose extra costs, i.e., make it necessary to use more resources to produce a given output, they may well be worthwhile. To prohibit the use of certain poisonous substances, or to require special precautions in their use, to limit working hours, or to require certain sanitary arrangements, is fully compatible with the preservation of competition. The only question here is whether, in the particular instance, the advantages gained are greater than the social costs which they impose. Nor is the preservation of competition incompatible with an extensive system of social services, so long as the organization of these services is not designed in such a way as to make competition ineffective over wide fields. It is regrettable, though not difficult to explain, that in the past, much less attention has been given to the positive requirements of a successful working of the competitive system than to these negative points. The functioning of a competition not only requires adequate organization of certain institutions like money, markets, and channels of information, some of which can never be adequately provided by private enterprise, but it depends above all on the existence of an appropriate legal system, a legal system designed both to preserve competition and to make it operate as beneficially as possible. It is by no means sufficient that the law should recognize the principle of private property and freedom of contract. Much depends on the precise definition of the right of property, as applied to different things. The systematic study of the forms of legal institutions which will make the competitive system work efficiently has been sadly neglected, and strong arguments can be advanced that serious shortcomings here, particularly with regard to the law of corporations and of patents, not only have made competition work much less effectively than it might have done, but have even led to the destruction of competition in many spheres. There are, finally, undoubted fields where no legal arrangements can create the main condition on which the usefulness of the system of competition and private property depends, namely, that the owner benefits from all the useful services rendered by his property, and suffers for all the damages caused to others by its use. Where, for example, it is impracticable to make the enjoyment of certain services dependent on the payment of a price, competition will not produce the services, and the price system becomes similarly ineffective when the damage caused to others by certain uses of property cannot be effectively charged to the owner of that property. In all these instances, there is a divergence between the items which enter into private calculation, and those which affect social welfare. And whenever this divergence becomes important, some method other than competition may have to be found to supply the services in question. Thus, neither the provision of signposts on the roads, nor, in most circumstances, that of the roads themselves, can be paid for by every individual user. Nor can certain harmful effects of deforestation, of some methods of farming, or of the smoke and noise of factories be confined to the owner of the property in question, or to those who are willing to submit to the damage for an agreed compensation. In such instances, we must find some substitute for the regulation by the price mechanism. But the fact that we have to resort to the substitution of direct regulation by authority where the conditions for the proper working of competition cannot be created does not prove that we should suppress competition where it can be made to function. To create conditions in which competition will be as effective as possible, to supplement it where it cannot be made effective, to provide the services which, in the words of Adam Smith, though they may be in the highest degree advantageous to a great society, are, however, of such nature that the profit could never repay the expense to any individual or small number of individuals. These tasks provide, indeed, a wide and unquestioned field for state activity. In no system that could be rationally defended would the state just do nothing. An effective competitive system needs an intelligently designed and continuously adjusted legal framework as much as any other. even the most essential prerequisite of its proper functioning, the prevention of fraud and deception, including exploitation of ignorance, provides a great, and by no means yet fully accomplished, object of legislative activity. The task of creating a suitable framework for the beneficial working of competition had, however, not yet been carried very far when states everywhere turned from it to that of supplanting competition by a different and irreconcilable principle. The question was no longer one of making competition work and of supplementing it, but of displacing it altogether. It is important to be quite clear about this. The modern movement for planning is a movement against competition as such, a new flag under which all the old enemies of competition have rallied. And although all sorts of interests are now trying to re-establish under this flag privileges which the liberal era swept away, it is socialist propaganda for planning which has restored to respectability among liberal-minded people opposition to competition, and which has effectively lulled the healthy suspicion which any attempt to smother competition used to arouse. Of late, it is true, some academic socialists, under the spur of criticism and animated by the same fear of the extinction of freedom in a centrally planned society, have devised a new kind of competitive socialism, which they hope will avoid the difficulties and dangers of central planning and combine the abolition of private property with the full retention of individual freedom. Although some discussion of this new kind of socialism has taken place in learned journals, it is hardly likely to recommend itself to practical politicians. If it ever did, it would not be difficult to show, as the author has attempted elsewhere, see Economica, 1940, that these plans rest on a delusion and suffer from an inherent contradiction. It is impossible to assume control over all the productive resources without also deciding for whom and by whom they are to be used. Although, under this so-called competitive socialism, the planning by the central authority would take somewhat more roundabout forms, its effects would not be fundamentally different, and the element of competition would be little more than a sham. What, in effect, unites the socialists of the left and the right is this common hostility to competition, and their common desire to replace it by a directed economy. Though the terms capitalism and socialism are still generally used to describe the past and the future forms of society, they conceal rather than elucidate the nature of the transition through which we are passing. Yet, though all the changes we are observing tend in the direction of a comprehensive central direction of economic activity, the universal struggle against competition promises to produce, in the first instance, something in many respects even worse, a state of affairs which can satisfy neither planners nor liberals, a sort of syndicalist or corporative organization of industry in which competition is more or less suppressed, but planning is left in the hands of the independent monopolies of the separate industries. This is the inevitable first result of a situation in which the people are united in their hostility to competition, but agree on little else. By destroying competition in industry after industry, this policy puts the consumer at the mercy of the joint monopolists' action of capitalists and workers in their best organized industries. Yet, although this is a state of affairs which in wide fields has already existed for some time, and although much of the muddled, and most of the interested, agitation for planning aims at it, it is not a state which is likely to persist or can be rationally justified. Such independent planning by industrial monopolies would, in fact, produce effects opposite to those at which the argument for planning aims. Once this stage is reached, the only alternative to a return to competition is the control of the monopolies by the state, a control which, if it is to be made effective, must become progressively more complete and more detailed. It is this stage we are rapidly approaching. When, shortly before the war, a weekly magazine pointed out that there were many signs that British leaders, at least, were growing accustomed to thinking in terms of national development by controlled monopolies, this was probably a true estimate of the position as it then existed. Since then, this process has been greatly accelerated by the war, and its grave defects and dangers will become increasingly obvious as time goes on. The idea of complete centralization of the direction of economic activity still appalls most people, not only because of the stupendous difficulty of the task, but even more because of the horror inspired by the idea of everything being directed from a single center. If we are, nevertheless, rapidly moving toward such a state, this is largely because most people still believe that it must be possible to find some middle way between atomistic competition and central direction. Nothing, indeed, seems at first more plausible, or is more likely to appeal to reasonable people, than the idea that our goal must be neither the extreme decentralization of free competition, nor the complete centralization of a single plan, but some judicious mixture of the two methods. Yet, mere common sense proves a treacherous guide in this field. Although competition can bear some admixture of regulation, it cannot be combined with planning to any extent we like without ceasing to operate as an effective guide to production. Nor is planning a medicine which, taken in small doses, can produce the effects for which one might hope from its thoroughgoing application. Both competition and central direction become poor and inefficient tools if they are incomplete. They are alternative principles used to solve the same problem, and a mixture of the two means that neither will really work, and that the result will be worse than if either system had been consistently relied upon. Or, to express it differently, planning and competition can be combined only by planning for competition, but not by planning against competition. It is of the utmost importance to the argument of this book for the reader to keep in mind that the planning against which all our criticism is directed is solely the planning against competition, the planning which is to be substituted for competition. This is the more important, as we cannot, within the scope of this book, enter into a discussion of the very necessary planning which is required to make competition as effective and beneficial as possible. But as in current usage, planning has become almost synonymous with the former kind of planning, it will sometimes be inevitable, for the sake of brevity, to refer to it simply as planning, even though this means leaving to our opponents a very good word meriting a better fate. Chapter 4. The Inevitability of Planning. We were the first to assert that the more complicated the forms assumed by civilization, the more restricted the freedom of the individual must become. Benito Mussolini. It is a revealing fact that few planners are content to say that central planning is desirable. Most of them affirm that we can no longer choose, but are compelled by circumstances beyond our control to substitute planning for competition. The myth is deliberately cultivated that we are embarking on the new course not out of free will, but because competition is spontaneously eliminated by technological changes which we neither can reverse nor should wish to prevent. This argument is rarely developed at any length. It is one of the assertions taken over by one writer from another until, by mere iteration, it has come to be accepted as an established fact. It is, nevertheless, devoid of foundation. The tendency toward monopoly and planning is not the result of any objective facts beyond our control, but the product of opinions fostered and propagated for half a century, until they have come to dominate all our policy. Of the various arguments employed to demonstrate the inevitability of planning, the one most frequently heard is that technological changes have made competition impossible in a constantly increasing number of fields, and that the only choice left to us is between control of production by private monopolies and direction by the government. This belief derives mainly from the Marxist doctrine of the concentration of industry, although, like so many Marxist ideas, it is now found in many circles which have received it at third or fourth hand and do not know whence it derives. The historical fact of the progressive growth of monopoly during the last 50 years and the increasing restriction of the field in which competition rules is, of course, not disputed, although the extent of the phenomenon is often greatly exaggerated. For a fuller discussion of these problems, see Professor Lionel Robbins' essay, The Inevitability of Monopoly, The Economic Basis of Class Conflict, 1939, pages 45 to 80. The important question is whether this development is a necessary consequence of the advance of technology, or whether it is simply the result of the policies pursued in most countries. We shall presently see that the actual history of this development strongly suggests the latter. But we must first consider in how far modern technological developments are of such a kind as to make the growth of monopolies in wide fields inevitable. The alleged technological cause of the growth of monopoly is the superiority of the large firm over the small, owing to the greater efficiency of modern methods of mass production. Modern methods, it is asserted, have created conditions in the majority of industries where the production of the large firm can be increased at decreasing costs per unit, with the result that the large firms are everywhere underbidding and driving out the small ones. This process must go on until in each industry only one or at most a few giant firms are left. This argument singles out one effect sometimes accompanying technological progress. It disregards others which work in the opposite direction, and it receives little support from a serious study of the facts. We cannot here investigate this question in detail, and must be content to accept the best evidence available. The most comprehensive study of the facts undertaken in recent times is that by the Temporary National Economic Committee on the Concentration of Economic Power. The final report of this committee, which certainly cannot be accused of an undue liberal bias, arrives at the conclusion that the view according to which the greater efficiency of large-scale production is the cause of the disappearance of competition finds scant support in any evidence that is now at hand. Final Report and Recommendations of the Temporary National Economic Committee, 77th Congress, First Session, Senate Document Number 35, 1941, page 89. And the detailed monograph on the question which was prepared for the committee sums up the answer in this statement. The superior efficiency of large establishments has not been demonstrated. The advantages that are supposed to destroy competition have failed to manifest themselves in many fields, nor do the economies of size, where they exist, invariably necessitate monopoly. The size or the sizes of the optimum efficiency may be reached long before the major part of a supply is subjected to such control. The conclusions that the advantage of large-scale production must lead inevitably to the abolition of competition cannot be accepted. It should be noted, moreover, that monopoly is frequently the product of factors other than the lower costs of greater size. It is attained through collusive agreement and promoted by public policies. When these agreements are invalidated, and when these policies are reversed, competitive conditions can be restored. See Wilcox, Competition and Monopoly in American Industry, Temporary National Economic Committee Monograph Number 21, 1940, page 314. An investigation of conditions in England would lead to very similar results. Anyone who has observed how aspiring monopolists regularly seek and frequently obtain the assistance of the power of the state to make their control effective can have little doubt that there is nothing inevitable about this development. This conclusion is strongly supported by the historical order in which the decline of competition and the growth of monopoly manifested themselves in different countries. If they were the result of technological developments, or a necessary product of the evolution of capitalism, we should expect them to appear first in the countries with the most advanced economic system. In fact, they appear first during the last third of the 19th century in what were then comparatively young industrial countries, the United States and Germany. In the latter country especially, which came to be regarded as the model country typifying the necessary evolution of capitalism, the growth of cartels and syndicates has, since 1878, been systematically fostered by deliberate policy. Not only the instrument of protection, but direct inducements, and ultimately compulsion, were used by the governments to further the creation of monopolies for the regulation of prices and sales. It was here that, with the help of the state, the first great experiment in scientific planning and conscious organization of industry led to the creation of giant monopolies, which were represented as inevitable growths 50 years before the same was done in Great Britain. It is largely due to the influence of German socialist theoreticians, particularly Sombart, generalizing from the experience of their country that the inevitable development of the competitive system into monopoly capitalism became widely accepted. That in the United States, a highly protectionist policy made a somewhat similar development possible seemed to confirm this generalization. The development of Germany, however, more than that of the United States, came to be regarded as representative of a universal tendency, and it became a commonplace to speak, to quote a widely read political essay of recent date, of Germany, where all the social and political forces of modern civilization have reached their most advanced form. Reinhold Niebuhr, Moral Man and Immoral Society, 1932. How little there was of inevitability in all this, and how much is the result of deliberate policy, becomes clear when we consider the position in England until 1931, and the developments since that year in which Great Britain also embarked upon a policy of general protection. It is only a dozen years since, except for a few industries which had obtained protection earlier, British industry was on the whole as competitive as perhaps at any time in its history. And although during the 1920s it suffered severely from incompatible policies followed with regard to wages and to money, at least the years up to 1929 compare with regard to employment and general activity not unfavorably with the 1930s. It is only since the transition to protection and the general change in British economic policy accompanying it that the growth of monopolies has proceeded at an amazing rate and has transformed British industry to an extent the public has scarcely yet realized. To argue that this development has anything to do with the technological progress during this period, that technological necessities, which in Germany operated in the 1880s and 1890s, made themselves felt here in the 1930s, is not much less absurd than the claim, implied in a statement of Mussolini, that Italy had to abolish individual freedom before other European people because its civilization had marched so far in advance of the rest. Insofar as England is concerned, the thesis that the change in opinion and policy merely follows an inexorable change in the facts can be given a certain appearance of truth, just because the nation has followed at a distance the intellectual developments elsewhere. It could thus be argued that monopolistic organization of industry grew up in spite of the fact that public opinion still favored competition, but that outside events frustrated their wishes. The true relation between theory and practice becomes, however, clear as soon as we look to the prototype of this development, Germany. That there the suppression of competition was a matter of deliberate policy, that it was undertaken in the service of the ideal which we now call planning, there can be no doubt. In the progressive advance toward a completely planned society, the Germans, and all the people who are imitating their example, are merely following the course which 19th-century thinkers, particularly Germans, have mapped out for them. The intellectual history of the last 60 or 80 years is indeed a perfect illustration of the truth that, in social evolution, nothing is inevitable but thinking makes it so. The assertion that modern technological progress makes planning inevitable can also be interpreted in a different manner. It may mean that the complexity of our modern industrial civilization creates new problems with which we cannot hope to deal effectively except by central planning. In a sense, this is true, yet not in the wide sense in which it is claimed. It is, for example, a commonplace that many of the problems created by a modern town, like many other problems caused by close contiguity in space, are not adequately solved by competition. But it is not these problems, like those of the public utilities, etc., which are uppermost in the minds of those who invoke the complexity of modern civilization as an argument for central planning. What they generally suggest is that the increasing difficulty of obtaining a coherent picture of the complete economic process makes it indispensable that things should be coordinated by some central agency if social life is not to dissolve in chaos. This argument is based on a complete misapprehension of the working of competition. Far from being appropriate only to comparatively simple conditions, It is the very complexity of the division of labor under modern conditions which makes competition the only method by which such coordination can be adequately brought about. There would be no difficulty about efficient control or planning were conditions so simple that a single person or board could effectively survey all the relevant facts. It is only